revealing its gruesome contents. "I guess we missed this one," Brian said dully as he stared at the skeleton shoved into the trunk. Unlike most of the skulls they had found on board, this man's skull remained attached to the rest of his skeleton, while remnants of his suit hung limply from the bones, bones folded like a pretzel into the barnacle-encrusted trunk. Brian leaned closer and examined the remains.
"By what's left of his clothing, I'd say it was a man. I wonder why they put him in here."
Joe reached out and touched the skull, gently turning it from side to side.
"I don't see a bullet. Do you think he was shoved in here alive?"
Brian shook his head.
"If he was, I don't see any signs that he tried to get out."
After Joe pulled back his hand, Brian reached out and gently moved what was left of the shirt's fabric to one side, exposing the skeleton's ribcage.
"No, he was killed here." "What is it?"
Joe leaned in, his head just inches from Brian's, as the two officers hovered over the open trunk. Brian pointed to the small metal object resting on the bottom of the trunk, below the ribcage.
"I'd say that's a bullet. My guess, they shot him in the chest, not in the head, like the others. I wonder why they bothered putting him in the trunk."
Joe stood up straighter, no longer leaning over the remains.
"I don't know," Brian muttered, reaching for the skeleton's right hand. "But this might be able to help us identify him." "A ring?" Joe asked.
With his gloved hand, Brian slipped the gold ring off the bony finger, examining it.
"Not just any ring. It's a Masonic ring."
Tilting it from side to side, he looked closer, searching for an inscription.
"Anything?" Joe asked. "Looks like initials, but I can't tell. I'll need a magnifying glass." "Old man," Joe teased, taking the ring from Brian. "Let me see."
He studied it for a moment, holding it near one of the floodlights. Finally, he said,
"J.W. J.W. By the way he's dressed, I don't think he's part of the crew. And I don't remember any of the passengers with those initials."
Joe handed the ring back to Brian and then pulled his cell phone from his pocket. After searching through the notes he had stored, he came to what he was looking for. Shaking his head, he looked up at Brian and said,
"No, I don't have a passenger with those initials." "What about the last name?" Brian asked. "What do you mean?" "Maybe it's not his ring. Maybe it was his father's. Same last initial, different first initial."
Joe took a second look, shook his head, and tucked the phone back in his pocket.
"No, none of the passengers' last names started with a W."
It was dark by the time Stella and Roland returned to Marlowe House. They had driven their car up the block to see the wreckage instead of walking. Roland was willing to walk, in spite of his artificial knee. It was Stella who had insisted they drive the short distance. Instead of returning immediately to Marlowe House after their visit to the Eva Aphrodite, they headed to town in search of a restaurant for dinner. Roland enjoyed the Friday night special of fish and chips. Stella, not so much. She claimed hers was greasy and returned it to the kitchen, after eating two-thirds of the meal. At Marlowe House, they found Lily and Danielle in the living room, sitting side by side on the sofa. The Sterlings hadn't yet met Lily. Stella's gaze went immediately to Lily's right arm and the dragon tattoo.
"What would ever possess you to get something like that?" Stella gasped.
"Stella, please," Roland said under his breath.
"Why can't I ask? If a young girl puts something like that on her body for all to see, then she must want people to look at her. So why is it wrong for me to ask a simple question? I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask her about it."
Lily glanced down at her right arm and then back to Stella.
"Well, it all started with tequila."
Stella arched her brows.
Tequila?
Lily nodded solemnly. And an ill-advised trip to Mexico.
You got a tattoo in Mexico? Stella gasped.
Lily shrugged. I can't really be sure. When I woke up, I was in San Diego.
You got a tattoo when you were drunk?
Isn't that when most people get tattoos? Lily asked innocently.
If so, our generation has a serious drinking problem, Danielle muttered under her breath as she rolled her eyes over Lily's impromptu explanation.
Abruptly changing the subject, Roland said,
It was most interesting down at the beach this afternoon. I was surprised at how large the boat is, or would it be called a ship?
It was a yacht. I suppose some might call it a ship. Others a boat, Danielle said. They took a dead body off the ship, Stella told them.
Dead body?
Lily and Danielle asked at the same time.
We assume that's what was in the trunk, Roland corrected.
Danielle frowned.
Did they say there was a body inside?
Stella shook her head.
No, they didn't say anything. In fact, your police aren't very friendly here. They wouldn't answer any of my questions. They kept telling us to stay behind the tape. But I overheard a couple of them talking before they brought the trunk out, and they said something about finding a body.
Roland shook his head.
I didn't hear them say that, but Stella insists.
Are you calling me a liar? Stella snapped.
No, dear, I'm just saying I didn't hear them.
Well, I did, she said stubbornly. Did you notice if they had lights set up on the boat? Danielle asked.
Well, that's what it looked like, Roland said.
The chief did mention something to me about bringing lights down and doing a more thorough search of the boat. It's possible they found more skulls.
Skulls? Roland asked.
So far, all they've really found are human skulls on board, and a few random bones.
That boat went missing almost 100 years ago, Lily explained. After so long, even bones will deteriorate. If you overheard them say they found a body, I wonder if that meant an actual body, which would indicate he or she was put on that boat recently, or that it was just skeletal remains, like the rest.
I'm sure they said they found a body, Stella insisted.
When Stella and Roland left for their room 15 minutes later, Danielle looked at Lily and asked,
Tequila? Seriously? I certainly wasn't going to waste my time telling her the real story, annoying woman.
One thing about running a bed and breakfast, you get all kinds.
I feel a little sorry for her husband, Lily said.
I know what you mean.
So tell me about the author. Ian went all fanboy when I told him who'd be staying here.
Danielle chuckled. Fanboy? For some reason, I don't see Ian going fanboy over anyone. Lily grinned.
I guess she's one of his favorite authors.
That's saying something, considering Ian's no slouch in the author department.
I know, but I guess even famous authors can crush over other authors.
I suppose it's a good thing she's old enough to be his mother, Danielle teased.
I think your butt's ringing, Lily chirped.
Funny. Danielle stood up and pulled her ringing phone from her back pocket. She glanced at it before answering.
It's Chris. Lily stood up. Then I'll let you lovebirds have some privacy.
19. Before coming to work that morning, Joanne had stopped by Old Salt's Bakery to pick up Danielle's favorite cinnamon rolls. Sitting quietly at the head of the dining room table, Danielle reminded herself she needed to give Joanne a raise for picking up the pastries. Not because she wanted to eat them, but because they seemed to be the only thing that could shut up Stella Sterling, who was now stuffing her third roll into an already full mouth. Sipping her coffee, Danielle looked down the table. To her right, Lily sat next to Hillary Hemingway, the mystery writer who was renting the Red Room for the next month. During check-in, Danielle had asked her new guest if she was related to that Hemingway. Hillary only laughed and said, "I wish." The Sterlings sat on the opposite side of the table. It was obvious to Danielle that Mrs. Sterling was determined to get her money's worth, hence the breakfast binging. Danielle found it hard to believe scrawny Stella Sterling ate copious amounts of food on a regular basis.
"What's everyone have planned for today?" Lily asked.
"I'd like to do some fishing," Roland announced.
"I didn't come here to fish," Stella snapped. "You can fish any time." With a frown, Roland looked at his wife.
"I can."
"I'd like to visit the local museum sometime while I'm here," Hillary said, looking from Lily to Danielle. "Stepping into the past feeds my muse." Stella frowned across the table at Hillary, but continued chewing instead of responding. "It's a nice little museum," Danielle said. "You can go through it in less than an hour, so it won't really take up much of your day. I think it's worth seeing, and it might inspire some story ideas."
"Aren't you going to the museum today?" Lily asked Danielle.
"Yeah, I am. I have to meet with the board of directors." Danielle took a bite of her cinnamon roll. "Danielle's donating an emerald from the missing Thorndike to the museum," Lily announced.
"Missing Thorndike?" Stella frowned. "Isn't that the necklace I read about? The one you found in the attic?"
"Yes. Technically speaking, the emerald is not from the missing Thorndike. That necklace is sitting in the bank safety deposit box with all its emeralds and diamonds. The setting originally had another set of stones that were stolen years ago and then replaced with what it has now. The emerald I'm donating to the museum is one of the stones that was stolen years ago."
"How did you get it?" Stella asked.
Hillary leaned forward, looking intently at Danielle.
"Yes, sounds fascinating."
"A descendant of one of the jewel thieves found one of the emeralds in her grandfather's belongings, along with information proving his father had been involved with the crime. She felt it was her responsibility to return the emerald to its rightful owner, so she gave it to me."
"I don't understand. Why are you the rightful owner? Just because you found the necklace here? Didn't Walt Marlowe steal the necklace you found?"
"That's what I read," Stella asked. "It's kind of an involved story." Danielle glanced down the table at Lily, who gave her a guilty shrug. Lily knew what Danielle was thinking at this point. "Did you have to bring up the emerald?"
"I'm listening," Stella said impatiently.
Danielle let out a deep breath and then forced a smile. "The necklace was originally owned by silent screen star Eva Thorndike. It was a family heirloom. She died at a young age from a heart condition. Before she died, she realized her ex-husband had removed the real diamonds and emeralds from the setting and replaced them with fakes. She didn't want her parents to know, so she asked Walt Marlowe, who was a close friend and by her side when she died, to steal it, which he did. He hid the necklace in the attic at Marlowe House."
"Oh, my. That is so romantic," Hillary said wistfully.
Scrunching up her face, Stella looked across the table to Hillary.
"How do you see that as romantic?"
"So the necklace you found had fake gems?" Roland asked.
Danielle shook her head.
"No. What Walt and Eva didn't know, her parents had discovered what their ex-son-in-law had done. So they had new diamonds and emeralds put into the setting. I believe they figured out Walt was the one who took the necklace, and why. They didn't say anything to him, but they left the necklace to him in their will. I suspect it was done to protect Walt in case he was ever found with the necklace after they were gone. As it turned out, Walt died first, and they never changed their will." You inherited his estate, which included the necklace? Hillary asked.
Danielle nodded.
Pretty much. Walt Marlowe left everything to his housekeeper, whose daughter married my grandfather's brother. My great-aunt left everything to me. As for the emerald, I don't believe I'm necessarily its rightful owner, yet I believe the Thorndykes would approve of the emerald going to the local museum. They have Eva's portrait there. You'll see it if you visit today.
Danielle sat at the large table in the back office of the museum. Sitting at the table with her were four Frederickport Historical Society board members, Millie Sampson, Ben Smith, bank manager Steve Klein, and someone she hadn't met before, Jolene Carmichael. Steve had introduced Danielle to Jolene when she first entered the back office. Jolene, a slender woman in her late 60s with dyed platinum blonde hair, sat quietly on the other side of the table, studying Danielle. Instead of standing and offering her hand when Steve made the introductions, Jolene remained seated, giving Danielle a stoic nod in greeting.
"Jolene just moved back to town," Millie said excitedly after Danielle had taken her seat. "We were so thrilled she agreed to fill the vacancy in the board. She'll bring so much to the Historical Society."
Danielle smiled across the table at Jolene, who looked as if she had just stepped out of the beauty shop with her meticulously coiffed short hair. Manicured nails sporting blood-red polish absently tapped the tabletop. It wasn't the tapping sound that caught Danielle's attention. It was the sparkling flicker bouncing off Jolene's many diamond rings. The woman had a ring on every finger, even her thumbs, and Danielle was fairly certain it wasn't costume jewelry. Looking up from the fidgety fingers, Danielle noted Jolene's designer silk blouse and diamond earrings. When Danielle's gaze settled on Jolene's face, she was a bit taken aback by the cool, less-than-friendly expression.
"So you lived in Frederickport before?" Danielle asked with forced cheerfulness.
"Jolene comes from one of the original Frederickport pioneer families," Steve explained.
"Yes, her family moved here even before Marie's," Millie added.
Jolene reached over to Millie and patted her hand.
"True, but Marie is much older than me, so I suppose technically she's been here longer."
Jolene smiled, her first smile since her introduction to Danielle.
"You grew up here?" Danielle asked. "Oh, yes, met my husband here. This is where we raised our family. But after he died, I decided to move closer to our daughter. She lives in New York. She's an attorney, just like her father. But I felt it was time to come home. I missed Frederickport." "And we're so glad to have you. Seems like most of our members are recent transplants, like Danielle here. It's good to have representation from the founding families," Millie said.
"Carmichael, why does that name sound familiar?" Danielle asked, looking across the table to Jolene.
"Because my husband, Doug, was Clarence Renton's business partner."
Momentarily speechless, Danielle stared at Jolene. Finally, she asked,
"The man in the fishing photographs in Clarence Renton's office?" Jolene nodded. "Yes, Clarence and Doug loved to fish. They used to joke about giving up their law practice and working on a fishing charter boat."
"I forgot how much those two enjoyed fishing," Steve said.
"It was such a shame Clarence murdered like that. People thinking he had actually killed himself."
Jolene shook her head.
"Just horrible. I'm so glad the truth finally came out. It wasn't right for people to think Clarence would do something like that."
Danielle could feel the eyes of the other three board members suddenly on her, waiting for her response. She looked across the table to Jolene, who seemed oblivious to how her words might sound, considering Danielle and Clarence's history. Unable to keep silent, Danielle spoke up.
I agree. I'm glad the truth came out and we know who killed Clarence Renton. But let's not forget the man murdered my cousin.
Jolene shook her head.
I'm sorry about your poor cousin, but Clarence was a good man. He was my husband's best friend. I knew him for years. Whatever happened with your cousin must have been an accident. After all, didn't I hear your cousin was on the run after stealing the missing Thorndyke when Clarence happened to cross her?
It was hardly an accident. Clarence Renton also tried to kill me. Jolene arched her brows.
Kill you? When? I heard you hit the poor man over the head and sent him to the hospital. Didn't they even arrest you?
Yes, I hit him, after he tried to kill me. And remember, he was embezzling from my aunt's estate for years. Jolene let out a bored sigh.
I really don't think it's fair to talk about dear Clarence this way. The poor man is dead now. Murdered. He isn't here to defend himself.
Danielle could feel her blood pressure rising. She glanced around the table, noting the dumbfounded expressions on the other board members' faces. It was as if they weren't sure what to say, so they kept quiet. Finally, Ben spoke up.
I think we'll all agree Clarence made some bad choices. And while we understand he was your old friend, Jolene, you can't expect Danielle to share those feelings.
That's easy for you to say. You never liked Clarence, Jolene snapped.
Ben let out a weary sigh.
Clarence and I had our disagreements over the years, but he's gone now, and I think we should focus on why we came here today. The emerald that Danielle is graciously donating to the museum.
Yes, the emerald, Steve agreed. Danielle glanced around the table. Steve, Millie, and Ben were now smiling, as if relieved the awkward moment had gone by.
I have something I'd like to discuss before we move on to the emerald, Danielle announced.
What's that? Steve asked.
It's my understanding the Historical Society's position on Walt Marlowe's death is that it might have been a suicide, when I've clearly proven otherwise, Danielle reminded them.
You don't know that for certain, Jolene said. Until my husband died, I had lived in Frederickport for my entire life. I grew up hearing the story of Walt Marlowe's death, how he hanged himself in the attic after his wife ran off.
The story wasn't true, Danielle insisted.
Does it really matter? Jolene asked.
It obviously matters to you that the world knows Clarence didn't kill himself, Danielle countered. Jolene gasped.
You certainly aren't comparing Clarence's recent death to someone who died almost 100 years ago.
Danielle seethed.
At least Walt Marlowe never killed anyone.
Apparently you don't know as much about the great Walt Marlowe as the rest of us, Jolene hissed. He killed my grandfather's brother and wife, not to mention all those other poor people.
What are you talking about? Danielle asked.
Jolene's great-uncle, Howard Templeton, and his wife, Thelma, were passengers aboard the Eva Aphrodite when it went missing. The museum acquired a diary belonging to a close friend of Thelma's, and from what I've read, it's entirely possible Walt Marlowe was responsible for the ship going down, Ben explained.
I don't imagine you know, Jolene said primly, since it's not common knowledge, but those people on the boat, they were murdered, shot in the head, every one of them.
20. gripping anger used to make Danielle cry. When debating topics she felt passionate about, tears would swell. It was a trait she loathed, one she had worked years to suppress. Yet now, sitting at the table in the back office of the Frederickport Museum, she battled tears. How could she ever explain her outrage at their slander of her dear friend Walt Marlowe, a man who had died before anyone at this table had even been born? Taking a deep breath, Danielle willed herself to calm down. Her heart continued its rapid beating, but the threat of tears receded. Once again, she was in control of her emotions. "I guess I'll have to read that diary myself," Danielle said with supreme calm. "Then you'll see what I'm saying," Jolene piped up. Ignoring Jolene, Danielle looked at Ben and said, "I've decided it would be best if I loan the emerald to the museum for their exhibit."
"Loan it? Are you saying you no longer intend to donate it?" Steve asked.
"I may eventually, just not now." Danielle smiled politely. Jolene looked from Millie to Ben.
"I don't understand. I thought you said she was donating the emerald, not loaning it."
Ben studied Danielle for a moment. When their eyes met, he gave her a smile.
"The emerald belongs to Danielle. She's obviously free to do with it whatever she wants. It'll be a wonderful exhibit for the museum, even if it's just on loan. That's not really so unusual."
"Maybe not unusual, but we can hardly purchase land for a new museum with someone else's emerald," Jolene snapped.
All eyes flashed to her.
"Excuse me? Who said anything about selling the emerald to buy land?" Danielle asked. "The understanding was the emerald would be on display with the Eva Thorndike portrait."
"And it would. But eventually, if we found a buyer for it, I'm sure even Eva Thorndike would rather see the emerald put to better use. If we're lucky, the buyer might be willing to keep it on display for a while. Displays rotate all the time at museums. Certainly you didn't expect the Historical Society to hold on to the emerald indefinitely, did you?" Jolene asked.
"Of course, we were going to talk to you about it first," Steve assured her. "We would never accept such a donation without full disclosure of our intentions. In fact, that's why we're here today, to discuss what we had in mind for your most generous donation."
Millie added, "I know your bed and breakfast is in Walt Marlowe's home, and you have a sense of loyalty to his memory. But we can't really rewrite history to fit what we wish it was. That would be going against everything the Historical Society stands for."
"I agree," Danielle said with a nod. "I would never expect the museum to present fairy tales to its visitors. But the information I've uncovered about Walt Marlowe's death does not support suicide. Talk to Joe Morelli. He reviewed the coroner's report. Walt Marlowe was murdered. Even Emma Jackson verified the fact that Walt Marlowe's brother-in-law was in Frederickport when Walt was murdered."
"That old colored woman," Jolene said with a snort. "What is she? 120 or something?"
"I don't think they call them colored anymore," Millie said with a gentle scold.
"Oh, pshaw. Fact is, Emma Jackson had no business living in Oregon back then. Nothing but a lawbreaker. Not someone whose word I'm going to take," Jolene insisted.
Danielle noted the uncomfortable glances exchanged between the other board members as they looked from Jolene to Danielle.
"You aren't seriously condoning a law that made it illegal for black people to live in Oregon, are you?" Danielle asked incredulously.
Jolene shrugged indifferently.
"I had nothing to do with that law. I wasn't even born yet.
But it was the law at the time, and the fact she was living in Oregon when it was in effect makes her a lawbreaker. It may be unpleasant, but it's true. Just like with Wald Marlowe, just because you'd rather believe he was murdered than did something as sinful as commit suicide doesn't change the facts.
No, the facts support murder, not suicide, Danielle said with forced calm. Jolene stood abruptly and looked at Danielle.
I won't belabor our obvious differences in opinion regarding historical fact and conjecture.
She turned her attention to the other board members.
If Miss Boatman won't be donating the emerald to the Historical Society, I see no reason for me to stay. You certainly don't need me to confer on a simple loan to the museum, although I'm not sure why we spent so much money for a display case for something she can remove at any time.
That was pleasant, Ben said dryly
after Jolene left the office a few minutes later. Millie let out a weary sigh.
Oh, I forgot how Jolene can be a little difficult sometimes.
I really did not expect it to go this way today, Steve added. I don't know Jolene that well. She moved from Frederickport not long after I moved here. I really thought she'd be an asset to the Historical Society, considering her ancestors were Frederickport pioneers. But I really was surprised at her defense of Clarence Renton. I'm sorry, Danielle. I had no idea she'd carry on like that.
I have to admit that surprised me, too, Millie conceded.
I wish I could say I was surprised, Ben confessed. Fact is, I was a little concerned about what she might say if Clarence was brought up.
Why didn't you say anything? Millie asked. Ben shrugged in response. I'm not trying to be difficult about the Thorndike Emerald, Danielle spoke up. I hope you can understand, but I do feel a loyalty toward Wald Marlowe. And if the museum portrays him unfairly, then I have to reevaluate my support of the Historical Society.
Are you saying you won't support the Historical Society if you don't get your way? Millie asked.
Absolutely not. But Millie, you know the facts are there. Wald Marlowe did not commit suicide. To tweak the story because you imagine it might increase traffic to the museum is just as wrong as me expecting the museum to alter history because I prefer another version.
To be honest, I think Danielle's version is more interesting, Steve said.
And what is Danielle's version? Millie asked impatiently.
That for years everyone believed Marlowe killed himself, and then Danielle uncovered new information that suggested Marlowe's wife and brother-in-law conspired to kill him, Steve explained.
But isn't that what we're saying? Millie asked.
Not exactly, Ben admitted. We have been leaning a bit back to the suicide story, suggesting to our visitors it's still an unsolved mystery.
It is, Millie said stubbornly.
Danielle shook her head. No, it's not, Millie. Steve let out a sigh and glanced at his watch.
I really need to get going. I promised my wife I'd finish painting the den.
I need to go, too. What did you decide about the emerald? Millie asked.
Danielle glanced from Millie to Steve, considering the question. Ben stood up.
Why don't you two go? I'll stay here and discuss the emerald with Danielle. I think for now it would be best if it was simply on loan with the museum until Danielle feels more comfortable.
I also have some questions for you about that diary, Danielle told him.
So, what do you want to know about the diary? Ben asked Danielle
after Millie and Steve left. The two sat alone in the museum office.
Why do you think Wald Marlowe killed those people? Danielle asked.
I can't believe he would do something like that.
You mentioned you read something in the diary that supports that theory. What?
The diary belonged to Ethel Pearson, a close friend of Thelma Templeton, Ben began. One of the women who was killed on the Eva Aphrodite.
I guess the chief has talked to you about what they found.
Yes, those people had been shot. Murdered.
Thelma is related to Jolene?
Yes, by marriage. Jolene's paternal grandfather was Ralph Templeton. Ralph's brother was Howard Templeton. Howard was married to Thelma. Howard and Thelma were on the Eva Aphrodite when it went down.
What does Ethel's diary have to do with any of this?
There was an estate sale a few months back. Someone came across the diary, realized its author had lived in Frederickport during the year she wrote in it, so they donated it to the museum.
Certainly, Ethel didn't know Thelma had been murdered.
No, and I didn't either when I first read the diary. But after Chief MacDonald came into the museum, asking about the Eva Aphrodite, I told him about what I'd read in the diary.
Which was?
Ethel suspected Thelma was having an affair. She confronted her several times, and finally Thelma confessed, telling her she was secretly seeing Walt Marlowe.
But how does that make Walt a killer?
According to Ethel, Thelma's lover had gotten violent. Apparently, Ethel walked in on her when she was dressing, and she was covered with bruises. At first, she thought Howard was responsible. This was before Ethel knew of Thelma's affair.
Are you saying Walt Marlowe was physically abusive to his lover?
It does happen.
Danielle shook her head. I don't believe that. Walt would never hit a woman. Ben laughed. Noting Danielle's lack of shared amusement, Ben stopped laughing.
I'm sorry, Danielle, but you have to admit your defense of a man who died almost 100 years ago is a little amusing, perhaps even a little disturbing.
Disturbing? How?
For one thing, you're living in his house. Perhaps you're a little too wrapped in the past. Whatever Walt Marlowe may have done is ancient history. While I'm a lover of history, I find it best to look back with a critical, objective eye. If not, then those sins of our fathers will do nothing but weigh us down.
Fine. Danielle let out a deep breath. Let's say Walt Marlowe was having an affair with Thelma Templeton, and he liked to smack her around. How does that lead him to ordering the hit, assuming he didn't do the job himself, of his yacht's crew and all its passengers?
For one thing, according to Ethel, Thelma was upset because Walt was trying to break it off. She told Ethel he didn't know who he was dealing with.
So, Walt wanted to end the affair. Why kill Thelma?
According to her diary, Ethel couldn't understand why her friend was so upset about losing a lover who beat her. She also wrote about how Thelma had the upper hand, considering Ralph's involvement with Walt Marlowe.
Ralph? Jolene's grandfather? What do you mean, his involvement with Walt?
Ralph and his brother Howard had inherited their family's business. That's where Jolene inherited her money. When Jolene said her husband loved to fish, she wasn't kidding. He was never much of an attorney. But considering Jolene's family money, he didn't need to be.
You're losing me here. What does this have to do with Walt?
It was common knowledge, according to the diary, that Walt and Ralph, Jolene's grandfather, were working on some business deal, and Howard wasn't sold on it. Had Thelma gone to her brother-in-law, confessed the affair, and convinced Ralph that Walt had seduced her, he would have probably ended the business association with Walt and possibly done more to hurt him. Jolene's grandfather was known for being rather ruthless.
So you think Walt killed all those people so Ralph wouldn't discover his affair with his sister-in-law?
It also got Howard out of the way. He was not in favor of the business alliance between his family and Walt. He may have been an occasional customer on Walt's party boat. They weren't friends. And after the Eva Aphrodite went missing and everyone on board was declared dead, Walt and Ralph formed a brief business alliance.
Brief? Danielle asked.
I'm not sure what happened. I can't find anything on it aside from what was in the diary. And Jolene didn't even know her grandfather and Walt had ever been partners.
I still don't see how any of this proves, or even suggests, Walt would do something like this.
Ben shrugged.
Maybe he didn't, but he did have a motive. And according to Ethel, when they eventually had a memorial service for Thelma, Walt didn't even bother to attend. He was out of town at the time. She was appalled at how little Thelma's death affected a man who she had been having an affair with for over 2 years.
21. Danielle hadn't expected to be gone that long. After pulling into the side drive at Marlowe House and parking, she checked the time. It was almost 4 p.m. Joanne's car was still out front, so Danielle knew she hadn't left. Wearily getting from the vehicle, she slammed its door shut and headed to the house. "How did everything go at the museum?" Joanne asked when Danielle entered the kitchen from the side yard. "Not quite as I thought it would." Danielle tossed her purse on the kitchen counter and opened the refrigerator. "Did you have some lunch?" Joanne asked, looking up from the vegetables she was dicing for Sunday's breakfast. "No, I was at the museum longer than I anticipated, and by the time I got the rest of my errands done, I just wanted to come home." Danielle grabbed some lunch meat and a jar of mayonnaise and then used her hip to close the refrigerator door. "You are going to wash your hands before you make yourself a sandwich, aren't you?" Joanne asked in a scolding tone. Danielle chuckled. "Yes, Mom." Setting the lunch meat and mayonnaise on the counter, she quickly washed her hands in the kitchen sink before grabbing a loaf of bread from the bread box. "When does the museum take official ownership of the emerald?" "The display case is supposed to be finished by this coming Wednesday. Maybe sooner. I may take it down then. It officially goes on display Friday, but for now the emerald is just on loan to the Historical Society." Joanne looked up from the chopping block and glanced over at Danielle. "You decided not to give it to them?" "Not right now. Probably eventually. Long story." Danielle sat down at the kitchen table with her freshly made sandwich. Before taking a bite, she asked, "Where is everyone?" "Your guests are all out. The nice mystery writer said something about stopping at the museum. Did you see her?" "No." Danielle grinned. "If she's the nice mystery writer, what are you calling the couple?" Joanne set her knife down and chuckled. While moving the freshly diced vegetables into a small Tupperware container, she said, "I'll be generous and just call them your downstairs couple, but she doesn't seem like a particularly happy woman." "No, no, she doesn't." Danielle took another bite of her sandwich. It was almost 5 p.m. when Joanne finally left for the day. Instead of going to the attic in search of Walt, Danielle went to the living room where she found Max curled up on the sofa, sleeping. When she sat down on the sofa next to him, he opened his eyes and yawned. "Hey, Max, you have a rough life." Smiling, Danielle reached out and stroked the cat's neck. Standing up, Max strolled over to Danielle, walking onto her lap. After making himself comfortable, ignoring her grunts due to his excess weight, Max settled down and began to purr.
Looking down at the black cat curled up on her lap, Danielle smiled while gently rubbing the white fur along the tips of his otherwise black ears.
"I thought you'd come upstairs," Walt said when he appeared in front of the sofa a moment later.
Both Max and Danielle looked up at Walt.
"Hi, Walt."
Danielle greeted him in a subdued voice. Max yawned and then settled his face back on his front paws, closing his eyes. He began to purr again. Walt took a seat across from Danielle.
"I saw Joanne drive off. How did it go at the museum?"
Danielle shrugged indifferently while still stroking Max's neck. "I met the new board member, Jolene Carmichael. She grew up in Frederickport, just moved back. Her husband was Doug Carmichael."
"Doug Carmichael? Should I know who that is?"
"Probably not. He was Clarence Renton's partner in the law practice. Jolene moved to New York to be with their daughter after her husband died a number of years ago." Waving his hand, Walt summoned a lit cigar. Before taking a puff, he narrowed his eyes and asked,
"Was he also embezzling from clients?"
Danielle shrugged. "I wondered that myself when she told me who she was. She's also the granddaughter of one of your old business partners." Prepared to take another puff of the cigar, Walt paused, flashing Danielle a brief frown.
"Business partner? Jack was my only business partner, and as far as I know, he never had any children."
Studying Walt's expression, Danielle licked her lips and then said, "Ralph Templeton."
"Ralph Templeton?"
Walt stood up.
"I haven't heard that name in years."
He began pacing the room. "From what she told me, her grandfather's brother, Howard, and Howard's wife were on the Eva Aphrodite when it went missing." Walt sat back down and looked at Danielle.
"So why did you call Ralph my business partner?"
"According to Ben, you and Ralph went into some business venture together." Walt shook his head.
"That's not true. Ralph Templeton would be the last man I'd do business with."
"According to Ben, you and Ralph were negotiating some business deal. His brother was against it. And after the Eva Aphrodite went missing, you two moved ahead with it, whatever it was." Leaning back in the chair, Walt smiled at Danielle.
"Where is Ben getting all this information?"
Licking her lips again, her gaze meeting Walt's, Danielle said,
"From Ethel Pearson's diary."
If Danielle expected a reaction, she didn't get one. Leaning forward, Walt continued to stare at her, a frown on his face, as if he was attempting to place Ethel Pearson. Finally, he said,
"I'm afraid you lost me. Who is Ethel Pearson?"
"A close friend of Thelma Templeton. Don't you remember her?" Walt shrugged and leaned back in the chair.
"I'm sorry, I barely remember Thelma, aside from the fact she was married to Howard Templeton."
"You don't remember Thelma?" Danielle asked incredulously. Again, Walt shrugged.
"I'm sorry. That was a long time ago, and we weren't exactly friends."
"What exactly were you?" Danielle asked in a humorless voice.
"Social acquaintances," Walt suggested.
"Is that what they used to call mistresses in your day?" Walt scowled.
"Mistresses? What are you talking about?"
"According to Ethel, you and Thelma were lovers." Walt sat there a moment, staring at Danielle, momentarily dumbfounded. Then he did something Danielle didn't expect. He began to laugh. Bending over from uncontained laughter, his cigar disappeared.
"Me? Me and Thelma Templeton?"
Walt choked out between fits of laughter.
"Would you please tell me what is so funny?" Danielle demanded.
She didn't get her answer, because in the next moment, Ian and Lily came through the front door with Sadie. Walt was still laughing when Sadie ran into the living room, jumping onto the chair with him. Walt disappeared, and Sadie jumped down to the floor.
"We saw your car out front," Lily said, when she walked into the room a moment later.
Danielle looked from the chair Walt had been occupying to the doorway, where Lily stood with Ian, their expression solemn.
"Is something wrong?" Danielle asked.
"It's Emma Jackson," Lily said when she walked into the room. As she approached the sofa, Danielle noticed Lily's red-rimmed eyes. She had been crying.
"Oh, you don't mean..."
Danielle said sadly. "Matthew called," Ian explained. He took a seat on one of the chairs across from Danielle, pulling Lily to him. She sat on his knee, leaning against his shoulder.
"She went peacefully," Lily said. "The neighbors found her. She was sitting in her rocker on the front porch and just went to sleep."
Wow. "She would have been 107 in just a couple months," Danielle murmured. "She had a good long life."
"Most of it was good," Ian corrected.
"You have a point," Danielle sighed. "I'm glad she was able to read her biography before she passed away."
Ian wrapped his arm around Lily and gave her a quick hug.
"Something I might not have written had this one not put that idea in my head."
"How often do you come across a 106-year-old black woman, one who is still sharp, willing to tell you what her life was like back when it was still illegal for blacks to even live in Oregon?"
"That didn't stop her," Ian chuckled.
"True," Lily smiled. "So when is the funeral?" Danielle asked.
"They aren't having one," Lily said.
"What do you mean? They have to have a funeral," Danielle insisted.
Ian shook his head.
"No, Emma was pretty emphatic about that. She didn't want a funeral. Instead, she told her family she wanted them to visit her when she was still alive, not spend money on airplane tickets after she was dead, which is one reason they all showed up at her 106th birthday party."
Danielle smiled. "I remember now. Matthew once told me she called all her kids, grandkids, nieces, and nephews on the phone and told them if they weren't coming to her birthday party because they were saving their money to pay travel expenses for her funeral, then they didn't have to worry about coming to either one because she wasn't having a funeral. Told them that if they loved her, they would prove it by showing up at her birthday."
Lily laughed. "I remember hearing that." They spent the next 30 minutes reminiscing about Emma Jackson and discussing the biography Ian had written about her. Finally, Lily asked Danielle about her visit to the museum.
"For the time being, I'm loaning the emerald to the museum. I won't be donating it, at least not yet." She then went on to explain her afternoon at the museum.
"I can't believe that woman would say those things to you," Ian said incredulously. "I wonder if her husband was as corrupt as his law partner. Was he also embezzling from his clients?"
"That's what Walt wondered," Danielle said without thinking. Ian frowned.
"Walt?"
Danielle froze. Her eyes widened.
"Did I say Walt?"
"Yes, you did," Lily said, suppressing her giggle. Danielle shrugged.
"I meant that's what I wondered."
"You got out of that one," Lily teased, after Ian went home with Sadie. She and Danielle remained sitting in the living room. Danielle glanced briefly to the ceiling.
"I guess I should go tell Walt about Emma's passing."
"Do you think you'll see her before she moves on?"
Lily asked. I doubt it. If she's not having a funeral, she'll probably move on to see her husband. Maybe she'll hang around and watch her kids go through her house. You know, I cried when I heard she died. I really liked Emma. But I'm not really sad that she's moved on, Lily said. She was pretty lucky that she managed to live in her house all this time and never had to go into a home. What a peaceful way to go, sitting in your rocking chair. You're right, but I do wish I could talk to Emma again. There are some things I'd like to ask her. I'm almost tempted to drive over to her house and see if her spirit is still sticking around. Why? How about we take a drive, Lily? Go grab some dinner. Lily soon discovered Danielle wasn't all that hungry, since she had eaten a sandwich 2 hours earlier. Yet leaving the house gave Danielle the opportunity to speak candidly with Lily, without Walt listening in. She needed to tell Lily what she hadn't shared when Ian was at Marlow House.
22. It had been a long day. Danielle hadn't seen Max since all her guests had returned to Marlow House. She had intended to slip up to the attic and talk to Walt after everyone went to bed, but Hillary Hemingway had left the door to her room wide open. When Danielle had passed by the open doorway a moment earlier, she noticed Hillary sitting in the easy chair, reading. If Danielle went up to the attic now, Hillary might get curious and follow her upstairs. The last thing Danielle wanted was for her curious mystery writer to catch her in the middle of a conversation with Marlow House's resident ghost. That would be extremely awkward. Especially since Hillary couldn't see him. Danielle climbed into bed, pulling the blankets up to her chest. She sat up, leaned against the headboard, and waited for Walt. Since she hadn't gone up to the attic, she expected Walt to pop into her room and say goodnight. She wanted to finish their conversation Lily and Ian had interrupted earlier. Danielle patiently waited, her hands folded neatly on her lap. Glancing up to the ceiling, she whispered, "Walt? Hello? Where are you?" After 30 minutes, Danielle could no longer keep her eyes open. Reluctantly, she leaned over and turned off the side lamp, sending her room into darkness. Scooting down in the covers, she pulled the blankets up to her chin and curled into a fetal position, closing her eyes. Within minutes, she was fast asleep. A woman laughed. Danielle opened her eyes. She looked around and found herself sitting inside what appeared to be a rustic, old-fashioned saloon. Yet she wasn't sitting on a chair. Where was she? Jazz music hammered its tune on a keyboard. Danielle looked down. She sat on an upright piano, her feet dangling in front of the piano player, who seemed oblivious to her presence. Letting out a surprised yelp, she pulled up her knees and wiggled to the end of the piano. From where she perched, she had a clear view of the entire room. A man laughed. Danielle looked to her left. Walt sat on the other end of the piano, dressed in a dark blue pinstriped suit, a lit cigar in his hand. The sound of the piano dimmed. It was barely audible. In the background, voices and laughter blended into a faint hum.
"What do you think?" Walt asked.
Ignoring her surroundings, Danielle focused on Walt. "I was going to come upstairs to talk to you, but I couldn't. I was hoping you'd come to my room to say goodnight."
"I'm here now,"
he smiled. "I wanted to tell you Emma Jackson passed away this afternoon."
Walt grinned. "Good for her."
Danielle's face broke into a smile. "Not a reaction I expected." Walt cocked his head and shrugged.
The woman had a long, full life. She lived almost 4 times longer than I did, and now she can see all the people from her life who've already moved on.
You think she'll see them?
That's what you're always telling me, Walt grinned. So, what do you think?
Where are we?